All right, we are back on the Tea Talk podcast brought to you by Flagstick.com. And there are a ton of stories going on this week. We're going to break it all down and more. Scotty, how are you today?
I'm doing great.
You think? I don't know. Sound a little slow. I don't know, man.
End of the outdoor golf season, so...
Let's get into that right away. I played... I'm going to just say it. It's the third last round of golf I've played this year, as my wife said. I'm already in some other hot... I'm in trouble right now. Let's just say that. I'm in trouble right now. We don't need to get into that. I screwed up dinner. I screwed up dinner real bad this week, Scotty. I was supposed to plug in the slow cooker. I just turned on the slow cooker. I didn't plug it in. So now the wife hates
things. Do not cook very well that way.
It's weird. The studio is not, like, it's cold down here. I think she put the air conditioning on or something.
No doubt.
I played my last fall round. It was more like winter. It was -2 degrees when we were out there at one point. Rain and wind. It was tough. That's for sure. But, you know, there's worse things you can be doing at this time of year. It could have been raking leaves or something. So here we are. And it's over. That's it. And next is heading south. But have you tried? You got a round in this weekend?
I did not.
Sort of.
Well, sort of. I played indoors this weekend. It's the start of the indoor season. I play with a couple of industry friends and a golf pro. We have a regular game on Sundays during the winter. So we got our first one in that way. And then unfortunately, I had to jump into a car and do about 8 hours of driving. So it was a tough weekend. I mean, recovering really from the late night golf. It was another weekend where we had tournaments going on in China and Taiwan. Just trying to, you know, keep up with that and stay up late at night and do some updates on the website in the morning and stuff. So, it was not a good weekend for sleep for me.
Yeah, you never really sleep anyway. You're not a big sleeper, but to be honest with you, I couldn't watch this tournament because I had no idea when it was on. Anytime I thought I did, I was wrong. It wasn't like Japan. When they were in Japan, I got it.
Yeah.
It was prime time. China threw me.
Well,
right,
I think
off.
Part of the problem, though, too, was they were replaying some of the round before, just before when it was going to come on. So you would turn it on. For an example, the women's tournament, you'd turn it on TV and you'd think you were watching the next round and really you're watching the round before. So that was kind of messed up. And then you realized, you know, it's 2 more hours before it comes on. Do I really want to stay up and watch the end of this? So I found myself sort of catching parts of it, you know, drifting back to sleep, wake back up again, check it in the morning, and, you know, hopefully see how well our Canadians were doing.
Yeah, well, why don't we get into the week that was in golf right now? So Rory McIlroy won that tournament, the WGC HSBC, the longest acronym in golf. he beat Xander Schauffele in a playoff. Four victories this year.
His third WGC of his career, but yeah, fourth victory. Now we have to say it's fourth in the calendar year. He had three in the tour year, the season with the wraparound, and now this is his first of this. So yeah, it's hard to track. But yes, let's just say in the calendar year, he's got 4 wins. If you look through the official world golf rankings, he's the player that has gained the most points in 2019.
And they're big wins, the Players, the Canadian Open, the fifth major.
Definitely.
Maybe. The Tour Championship, that's a nice one. Obviously, small field, but the best of the best all year round. And then now the WGC, which are always deep fields. You know, those no-cut events, you're going to get a lot of the big names showing up. But what a great year. I said at the start of the year he was going to have a big year. I did say he would win a major. He did not win a major. But I said this guy's dialed in now, right from the start. Something looks different with him. He looks like he's enjoying golf more. He's not coming out and saying all these little things about golf isn't the only thing I do and blah, blah, blah. He seems committed. And another win on top of that, the player of the year. There was some remarks whether that should happen, but this guy's, he's on fire. If he keeps up with this, people got to be scared. He could get back to world number one at some point here.
He could be close, actually. He can't catch Brooks Koepka, even if he wins the DP World Tour Championship that he's about to play in Dubai. But he's going to be close heading into next year. And I think the big thing for Rory is I think he just figured things out. Got married a couple years ago. And as you alluded to, you know, he talked about golf not being the only thing and whatever. He just, I think he's got to a place where he knows how much he plays, what his schedule looks like, what he does from a family side of things, what he does from a corporate side of things. and really is just dialed into how he best prepares. And as a result of it, you know, he's peaked when he's had to, with the exception, obviously, of those majors. I'm sure he's, you know, looking forward to, you know, changing that next year. But he's definitely, you know, a guy that you have to look out for and expect that, you know, Brooks is going to have to look out. And that number one spot is certainly not guaranteed. And he's pretty close to catching Brooks.
He's going to get there. I'm going to call it now. He's going to get
there.
Yeah,
I would agree. Yeah,
I don't see how he doesn't. I think Brooks has this nagging knee injury, though he had surgery. I think he's going to take a little bit of time off, and I think Rory might catch him on that alone. But, you know, we're coming into a lull. There's nothing going on the PGA Tour this week, which is nice. You know, this is the off season. We have an off season finally.
Except they're playing in Europe. They're playing in Turkey, but we'll see a few players in there. But we do have. There's no LPGA event this week. No PGA Tour event this week. So yeah, I guess you're right. That's a one week of off season.
I don't know what we're going to talk about next week. One thing we're finally. This is the Bermuda Championship.
We're done with it.
We're done with it. We talked about it last week. The worst trophy I've ever seen in professional golf. Great story came out of it, though, per usual.
We did say there would be an opportunity for somebody in this, and obviously Brendan Todd took advantage of that.
Yes, he did. This guy, I might have had a better world ranking than him at some point, considering he won a PGA Tour event in 2014.
Yeah.
Had the ball striking yips back in 2015.
Crazy.
Missed like 25 of 29 cuts,
yep.
15 straight. You know, we talked to, you know, Martin Trainer about that. It happens. So it can come back around. But yeah, this is a tough thing. Golf's tough. It can go in a second. He obviously got his card back last year, and here he goes. Comes and picks up a win at the Bermuda Championship. Just shows, you know, you can't take these alternate events off, even if the money isn't there, because it can change your life.
Yeah, it can. And I think it also shows you, you know, the fallacy a little bit of the world rankings. Yes, a player may not be playing well and be in current form, but if they're capable, and they've obviously he's won before and got his card back through the Korn Ferry Tour, you can't take those players lightly. And I mean, obviously, you shot 24 under there. This is a guy who started working with Bradley Hughes last year to sort of, you know, get his game back a little bit. And I thought it was interesting that, you know, Hughes had got him to read Rick Ankiel's book. And I don't know if you're a baseball guy, so I'm sure you know the Rick Ankiel story and some of the crazy pitches that he ended up doing. And the guy that, you know, was yipping pitches. And, you know, basically what ended up happening was Brendan read his book as well. And, you know, the book called The Phenomenon Pressure, The Yips and the Pitch That Changed My Life. But, you know, you could probably turn that into a golf book just with that title. And obviously Brendan Todd turned it around and got his win. And now he's going to head back into the higher parts of the rankings.
Well, to be honest with you, I've obviously heard Rick and Keel. I forgot about this book, but I know what I'm getting my dad for Christmas, that's for sure, because he's had the chipping yips for 5 years, and I'm sick of watching it, so there's your gift if you're listening to this podcast for Christmas. So, it's an awesome story. That was a beautiful golf course in Bermuda. I'll give him that, right on the ocean. Looked lovely. I'm not going to give him that.
Yeah.
It's not an event that's going to, I'm going to say it, it's not going to be back there next year. It just doesn't make sense, that field. I would love to see the viewers on the TV for that. Obviously, Sunday coming down, maybe there's some people, but just, I don't know, not good in my opinion.
Well, Bermuda Tourism was the big sponsor behind it, so the Tourism Authority there, I'm sure it's going to be back next year. I mean, does it mean it's going to be any more exciting? I don't think so. Is Brendan Todd going to be back there to defend? Probably not.
yeah, true.
You know, he's probably going to be working his way towards being in Shanghai next year as well. And, I mean, he probably wants to be there and playing for the bigger money as well. The tournament did provide a big opportunity for a Canadian as well. David Hearn tied for eighth there, which is great for him. Yeah, obviously, he's having a bit of a recovery in his game, and that does move him up 66 spots in the world rankings. He's back up to 404, so that's good for David Hearn. And you know, he's got a couple events coming up with the PGA Tour heading to Mayakoba, and they've got their event in South Carolina as well, the RSM. So there's more opportunities for those players as the guys like Rory take a little bit of a break.
Yeah, so the PGA Tour obviously wrapping up. Rory winning usually would bring everyone to talking about golf. No one is talking about that right now, because what happened at LPGA Tour Q Series is what everyone is talking about. Before we get to this story,
yeah,
a friend of the show, we've been talking about this girl all, you know, since the podcast started. Her boyfriend Ryan DeVoe has been on this podcast many a times,
right.
Lauren Kim is on the podcast this week. She got through Q school, 8 rounds of Q school, in amazing fashion, full status next year. And that, she's our interview this week. We're going to talk to her in a moment. We got to get into this Q school stuff. Cause this is crazy what's going on online right now.
Well, I think it's like a lot of things. People just get all hot about it over on Twitter or whatever. We just had a situation with Christina Kim. You know, she's a well-known player for a lot of people that know that, you know, she's played the LPGA Tour for quite some time. Definitely a vocal character. And unfortunately, she was, I wouldn't call it involved in an incident. She witnessed an incident.
Yep.
And as a result of it, you know, it was during the 6th round, and she saw basically, a player sort of, she flashed a caddy, this other player, confirmed a club selection from another player that she was about to hit the shot. And Christina Kim witnessed this. And basically, you know, she basically, first of all, talked to the rules official right away just to kind of clarify if it was an issue. And then after the round at the scoring, brought it up. And part of the reason, as she explained why she brought it up then, and I can relate because I've had this situation before where I've been at a tournament, she didn't really want to mess up the players during their round and really cause heat that way. The problem is that, you know, the two other players, Kendall Dye, and I think it's Dewey Weber. Yeah. Sure. Anyways, they both end up with violations. They both didn't get through anyways, but they end up with rules infractions. But the problem is that everybody was blaming Christina Kim. You know, people are online calling her a narc, all sorts of things for, you know what? First of all, she's protecting the field, which she's supposed to do. And, you know, she can't ignore that. And the other side of it is that, you know, it's also a rules violation if you do ignore it. And what I thought was odd about this was that people were discussing it on Twitter and they're freaking out. And they're probably the same people that when the USGA talked to Dustin Johnson during the US Open and they talked to him during the round, they said, oh, why doesn't he talk to them afterwards? You can't have it both ways, people. And, you know, she is not to blame for this. You know, yes, she put out a tweet saying about, you know the rules and stuff like this afterwards. Kendall Dye admits not knowing the rule, but I don't think her post that she had, and I've got that here if you want to read that out, but I thought that was kind of interesting, her response.
Yeah, so just for anybody that doesn't know, I'm going to read Kendall Dye's post here about what actually happened in her eyes, and then I'm going to give my thoughts on it as well. Everyone's had a take. Now you have to listen to mine. So it's my podcast. So here we go. But here's what she said. During the 6th round of Q series, I like Q school personally, but whatever. I flashed 3 fingers at a caddy, confirming a club selection of another player. I could have walked 2 steps over to the bag to find out this information. However, I did not know this was an infraction. I take 100% responsibility for the infraction, and shame on me for not knowing this was a rule. I have played professional golf for 10 years, and I've seen this done thousands of times between players, caddies, and media, and never seen one penalty called. I'm completely gutted for causing another innocent player 2 strokes during this incident, which was handled and closed in a private matter. However, I'm very disappointed in a fellow player's unprofessional public action for taking this to Twitter and to players and caddies in our field and causing a huge distraction for myself and others. Other players during such a... We lost all of our listeners. During such an important event, my character and track record should show that I had no intention to cheat. However, I take full responsibility for the penalty. As you should take full responsibility for the penalty. That being said, okay. A, she has some points in here in the sense of, does this happen in every single round to an extent? Yes. Now...
Clarify that.
What I mean by this is...
And we both caddied, so we know how this works.
What I mean by this is every single par 3, the first guy to hit or gal to hit, the other caddy or player will just walk over and look in somebody's bag.
Of course.
It happens. It's an advantage. It's not cheating. The only thing in the rule is you cannot ask
Correct.
For it. And she obviously... asked or told, I've already lost track here, of what happened. When she talks about... the media thing.
Oh,
that
is
different.
I got a kick out of that one.
Yeah, but that is different. That is something that they do for the guys on TV. When you see things
exactly.
When you see a guy on TV or a gal on TV and say he's hitting 7 iron, the way they find out that information
is
the
caddy
will make a little sign over to the media person in the middle of the fairway, yada, 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 and then they call up or whatever.
Yeah,
so that's not the same as this situation.
100%. It has nothing to do with the players. I mean, And I've had that situation. Jerry Foltz was out there doing the walk in Golf Channel. And that's something, you know, and other caddies make you aware of that, is that they're going to look for you to look for that club selection and see what's in there. But that has nothing to do with giving the information to another player to take advantage of that. So that is different. So for her to bring that in, yeah, not really the point. And continue on what you're going to say here, but it's interesting.
So in my opinion, Christina Kim isn't in the wrong at all. I think where Christina Kim may have gone wrong is how she handled it afterwards.
And she admitted that.
And you know, I mean, like, Club Pro Guy went at her. Club Pro Guy.
Club Pro Guy's not even a guy. It's a comedy team.
It's a comedy team. And he went at her and she got offended. He's like, you got to know. He's just trying to rattle you up. Who cares? Make light of it. At this point, things like this happen. It didn't matter. This person wasn't even close to getting through. It's just something to chat about. It does. She is right in a certain sense, but you're the one that made the infraction because someone calls you out on it. You know, If I mean, this is completely different, but like if I hit somebody with my car and no one sees it, right, and somebody calls and you saw, say, you know, you saw it and you call the police on me, am I blaming you? No, I'm the one that hit somebody with the car.
That's exactly it.
Sort of, I guess, in a way darker way, but you know what I mean? Like, take responsibility.
It's about personal responsibility, and that's the problem we have a lot in the society these days. We have a lot of people that just won't take personal responsibility. She took responsibility in a way, but at the same time, she chirped back. And,
deflected.
And I thought, exactly. And the fact that she said thousands of times, first off, no offense, but you have not played thousands of rounds as a professional. So there's an immense hyperbole that's there. But, you know, again, lots and lots being put into this. Lots of people going back and forth on Twitter. Obviously, we're still talking about it.
It's like people that say, sorry, I offended you by saying this. You're not sorry then.
No.
Because you're not. You're just saying sorry it. They're offended. You're not sorry for what you did.
Yeah.
Right? And that's kind of where she, you know, rattled. So we already lost all our listeners anyway, so just fast forward to this point. If you're done with this, either way.
And personally I've seen the situation. I've been involved in a situation where I was at a tournament where a player saw another player's violation. They said to me, should I tell them now or should I tell them later? And, you know, it wasn't a case of where anything was going to change right then. So it's like, you know, you talk to them later. You didn't have to tell them then. That was probably a worse thing to be able to do it there. And I've had it as well. I actually misscored at a tournament one time and I gave a player the wrong score. And then the other player actually told me between nines. Didn't matter to me. He could have told me afterwards, as long as I didn't sign my card. It was a brain fart on my side of things or whatever. It probably would have been better. He told me later, but it doesn't really matter. I mean, I still had the, you know, what would have potentially been a violation or whatever.
Still
but,
shot.
Right. But she's just trying to be considerate in some way of just not disturbing them during the round.
My question right now, and maybe I just didn't see it, has the caddy that wanted a confirmation, has he gone into the witness protection program? Because nobody's heard from this guy, which maybe
never
he's
really
not a vet out
one.
There. He's getting by unscathed. He or she, I don't even think it says, doesn't matter.
No.
They're technically the one at fault if they asked. If Kendall just gave that information, then she is. But, like, I don't know. It's odd. It makes no sense.
Yeah.
I'm on Team Christina Kim for doing it. I'm not on Team Christina Kim for what happened afterwards. I'm on Team Lauren Kim is
there
who I'm on because she finished T8 and now she has full stats on the LPGA Tour. And that's a good story. And we're going to talk to her about the Q School. That was awesome. And not none of this crap rules official garbage. So why don't we send over that interview right now with one of our favorites, Lauren Kim. All right, we would like to welcome to the podcast Lauren Kim. Last year, she finished 111th in the CME rankings and was forced back to LPGA Q School after 8 grueling rounds. She finished T8 and has her full card back for 2020. Lauren Kim, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
So how are you feeling after the last couple weeks? It's quite a grind, 8 rounds of LPGA Tour Q School. Obviously was successful, so I'm sure you're feeling good, but how are you physically feeling after all that?
That's a good question because I think I'm a little bit, my body's a little confused as to where I am and what's going on. I was able to rest for one day on Sunday We played like the little putting course out at Pinehurst, and then I flew home yesterday. And I woke up at 4:30 this morning for some unknown reason. I'm still trying to figure that out. So my days felt quite long. But yeah, I mean, I'm looking forward to taking a couple weeks off, putting the clubs away, and then coming back probably around American Thanksgiving to start practicing again for the offseason.
So for the Q series, I mean, now that it's broken into 2 4-round segments, there's not a lot of rest in between, but are those, you know, few days off at least helpful?
Yeah, I personally, because I think I've played, you know, this past year was my third year playing professional golf, and the second year on the LPGA. So I think, you know, being able to play week to week on tour and having those 3 days off and getting used to those 3 days off kind of makes the transition to Q series a little bit easier. Those 3 days are really important for just getting to know a different course. And just, yeah, giving your body and mind kind of a rest and refresh, hitting the refresh button before you start another tournament week. I think if it would have been 8 rounds straight, people would probably be losing their minds by now.
So, absolutely.
Yeah, having those few days is really important.
So what's your preparation like going into this, knowing it's going to be a grind?
You practice really hard for, you know, whatever amount of time that you designate for yourself. And then kind of going into it, the travel day and that stuff like that, you kind of taper almost in a way. At least that's what I do, and so I work really hard when I'm at home, and obviously, you know, coming from California, except for the West Coast swing on the LPGA, it's a long travel day, so I usually take travel days off, maybe do some putting if I get in early enough, but yeah, mainly take travel days off. And then once I'm at a tournament site, I usually just focus on getting to know the course, getting comfortable with the different grass or, you know, different green speeds or whatnot. But I think most of the bulk focused work is done at home, and then you kind of get on the road and kind of get along with it.
Pinehurst number 6 and number 9, the two courses that you play, they're kind of a bit different. How do you adapt to it that way?
Yeah, they were different. Number 6, we played last year for Q series actually. So I was more familiar with that course, and it probably showed in my scores, but yeah, the grass is different. You're chipping on to bent grass at number 9. So the greens are all bent, but everything else, grass wise is the same. So you're playing from Bermuda you're chipping from Bermuda onto Bermuda greens on number 6. And then you go to number 9 and you're chipping from Bermuda grass onto bent grass. And so it's a little bit of an adjustment. Luckily I grew up playing Poana and bent grass. So I was, it wasn't a foreign concept to me, but definitely the Bermuda mixed with the bent was a little bit strange. But yeah, the two courses are very different. I think number 9 was, people were saying that it was the one that Pinehurst acquired. So it wasn't one of the original Pinehurst courses. And it felt a little bit newer, but I'm not really sure about the timeline. But yeah, I mean, just it's cool to play. It's cool that they have the resources to give us 2 different courses, because I mean that's what you get on the LPGA, is just you go week to week and every course is so different, and they set up the courses differently too, so it's kind of a nice reflection of, like, a mini reflection of what the season looks like.
Well, it sounds like you're quite the student of the game, obviously knowing all the grass types. We've talked to many players on here, from the PGA Tour down to very low levels of golf, and you've mentioned, you know, the awareness of these type of things. What type of preparation does that include, or is this something you lean into your caddy for?
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because I do the caddy I had for Q Series is a guy that I've worked with before. He's caddied on the LPGA for years now, and he has a lot of experience with Florida grass and Florida Bermuda. So Bermuda doesn't grow in California, and it's like I'd have to drive crazy, obscene hours to find Bermuda anywhere on the West Coast. So that's kind of a bit of a challenge when, you know, we played our last event in Dallas, so that really helped. Bermuda was kind of fresh in my mind going into Q Series, but usually the adjustment, you know, the first event next year is in Florida, so I'm going to have to do some adjusting there. But yeah, I mean, just kind of keeping like a few key points in your head about how to hit short game shots or out of certain grass, or, you know, kind of key things to pay attention to, like grain and stuff on Bermuda grass, that you don't find, or that at least I don't find out here in California.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, what do you look for in these things? Because, like, for the listeners at home, there's so many that, you know, you can say Bermuda, bent grass, backyard grass, they all look the same to them, right? So what is the difference for your game personally?
Personally, so in bent grass, it's kind of easier to notice because all the, you kind of notice that all the blades of grass are standing up on their own. Whereas Bermuda grass, it's kind of looks like it's more matted down. And I think Bermuda grass grows from, like, you know, a lot of different stalks from one root. And so it creates, you just have to know, you know, to keep the club head a little shallower and more out to in swing path and, you know, really accelerate through the ball instead of kind of a more choppy swing. So yeah, I mean, just like little technical things like that. That's probably a lot more technical than.
I was gonna say that's your BA in science. Yeah, from Stanford, I know. University coming out, you lost me there. We're talking about roots of grass and.
Yeah, it's just little things that I've learned because I've struggled. I, you know, early in my junior career, I struggled a lot when I went to Florida and would compete, and these kids were like hitting these crazy shots out of Bermuda grass, and you know, I came from a place where I didn't even know that different types of grass existed. So yeah, it was interesting kind of just to pick up little different bits and pieces from different people about, you know, grass and how it grows. And it kind of makes sense when you put all the little pieces together and you're like, oh, that's why, you know, the shot came out differently or whatnot.
For you as well, you know, heading into this Q series, I hear that you possibly made some changes with equipment wise. Any other things that you did going into the Q series that prepared you differently?
No, I think equipment was the biggest one going into Q series. I changed, well, not really changed coaches, but started seeing Jorge Parada, which was last, so November of 2018 or December of 2018. So the earlier this year was kind of an adjustment for me, you know, learning his technique and how he teaches and how to put that into play during a tournament. So I kind of got off to a slow start there, and then kind of going through the year, I got used to that. He's able to come out to a lot of different tournaments and has a lot of different students on tour. So that makes it easy to see him on a regular basis. But yeah, mainly equipment going into Q series was the biggest thing. I changed all the shafts in my golf clubs, and it made a huge difference.
What was the specific change that you made? The adjustment in the shafts?
Yeah. So I went to go see Thomas Kalinowski. He's with KPS. Yeah, and so I flew down to Phoenix and saw him at Cool Clubs, and we had kind of had an idea already. I'd seen him before about what we wanted to do, but essentially, taking some weight out of my shafts, switching from steel to graphite, and then, you know, just being able to swing faster, getting the spin up and the height of the ball up, so which are all great things and really helped during that week.
Yeah, we're a bit of gear nerds on this podcast. Yeah. So we love this type of talk for sure. But let's step back a bit. You know, almost a year ago, 2 years ago now, we were close to not ever having this conversation as you thought about quitting golf. Is that true? Like, what is the story behind that, and what ultimately made you change that decision and end up, you know, full-time status on the LPGA?
Yeah, it's funny. I was on a different podcast after I had won my first Symetra event in 2018. And yeah, 2017 was a really hard year, to put it simply. I had graduated in 2016 and then was kind of in a limbo, you know, going through the whole qualifying process for the LPGA. I decided not to do the qualifying process the year before my senior year, like they have the system now with the deferring status and all of that. That didn't exist when I was in school. And so I just decided to graduate. And then I went through the whole qualifying process and actually came out with conditional LPGA status that first year in 2017. And when I look back on that time, I try not to say I try to say I live with no regrets, but this was one of the biggest regrets I have to this day, is not taking the LPGA status that I had. And that year I spent mostly in Symetra. I played 2 LPGA events out of probably the 8 that I would have gotten into. And I think in hindsight, it was probably a blessing in disguise, but at the time, you know, I had this LPGA status, and I saw Mariah, my classmate, who had chosen to take her LPGA status and was competing out on tour. And, you know, I was back on Symetra, which isn't a horrible place by any means. It's actually a great place where I was able to grow as a person and grow as a golfer. But, you know, you get caught up in the travel, and you get caught up in the grind and those 8-9 hour drives from event to event, and you kind of lose sight of why you play the game in the first place. And it becomes all about kind of survival and learning the ropes of professional golf and learning how to play week to week, and, you know, all the things that you learn in your first year out, whether it be on Symetra or LPGA. And so I think that kind of took over the forefront of my mind. And I remember specifically the 2 weeks where I was at my darkest moment was when we went to Garden City and Sioux Falls. And I actually got DQ'd from the Sioux Falls event because I assigned for the wrong score, for a lower score than I intended. And it was just like, you know, kind of a come to Jesus moment where I was like, wow, I really need to rethink this whole thing. I had never gotten DQ'd from an event, and it just showed where my mind was at. You know, it wasn't on the golf. It wasn't on, you know, being diligent about things. It was about, you know, just kind of getting lost in everything. And so, I came home after that event and did some like major thinking about really where I wanted to be and what I wanted to be doing. And I decided, you know, I talked to my parents, had long discussions with them about it. And I realized that if I had just, you know, hung up the towel and quit, first of all, it wouldn't have been easy. And secondly, I would have felt like I had left a lot out on the table, and I didn't give myself a full chance to really see what the LPGA is like and see if I'll really enjoy it. And so I kind of did some soul searching and realized why I loved golf and why I loved competing, and decided to stay. And I'm glad I did, because it's paid off, at least this year.
That's quite a tale. And obviously, you know, it takes a lot of just some inner thought and you know, just to really know, is this really what I want to do? What was your plan B if you didn't?
I don't really know what my plan B would have been. I've always, you know, growing up in the Silicon Valley and kind of seeing the VC world and the startup world and all of that, I think I would have enjoyed coming back and, you know, learning from mentors and stuff about, you know, venture capital, maybe something like that. I've always been really intrigued by, you know, the world I grew up in and kind of this whole culture of entrepreneurship and all of that. So I think I probably would have come back and tried to find a job, you know, in the corporate world. But, you know, everybody that, all my mentors, you know, that I was talking to during that time were like, you know, the working world will always be there, and you have this great opportunity to do something, you know, completely unique. And so, so I decided to stay.
When you speak of your mentors, was Coach Ann Walker from Stanford one of those people that was influencing you and talking to you about, you know, staying back out there?
Yeah, she's been a huge influence in my life. You know, ever since I was a freshman in college, she's actually not the coach that recruited me, because Caroline O'Connor was the old coach. And then my freshman year, Ann Walker came in. So Mariah and I had her from the beginning. And, you know, coming into college, I wasn't a top recruit in my class. I wasn't, you know, like a decorated junior player. I mean, I had won junior tournaments, but I was by no means like, you know, the top of my class. And even up until the day I signed to go to Stanford, I struggled with believing in myself, you know, like, is this really real? You know, am I really good enough to play, you know, for Stanford women's golf? And so I think Coach really helped me with that belief throughout my 4 years. And, you know, sophomore, junior, and senior year, I ended up being first team All-American, and things that started happening that I just never even could have thought, you know, entering as a little freshman in school. So she was huge, pivotal in that respect, you know, making myself you know, believe and that I could do, you know, great things with golf, and kind of supporting me in that respect. And yeah, it's fun to still practice on campus and see her every day and kind of just, you know, talk to her as a friend now. And she still coaches me and gives me advice when I'm on the road and texts me, you know, when I have a good round and stuff like that. So she's been a huge support in the sense of golf goes in like the mental game.
Being a Stanford grad, does that mean you have Tiger Woods' phone number?
That's a good one.
One of our teammates, one of the girls that I played on the team with, has his phone number because she lives near where he lives in Jupiter. And I never got his phone number, but Coach has it, obviously, because, you know, it's funny because he called us when we, just before we won the national championship my junior year, and then when we were in the finals my senior year, right before the final match both years, he called our team and kind of gave us a pep talk. And I think I have a photo on my phone of, like, you know, his name coming up on the car, Apple CarPlay or whatever it was. And
I got chills right now. You must have been fired up.
Yeah, he is. I mean, if there's anybody, you know, to give you a pep talk, it would be Tiger. And he's just, it's amazing. Like, you just, the words that come out of his mouth are just, you know, sacred in a certain way. And he's always been a huge role model and idol for me. And we got to meet him my junior year. And he's just so generous with his time, you know, especially with our programs, because, you know, it was a direct impact on his life, but also with, you know, kids and junior golf. And he spent the weekend just hitting balls, and, you know, whatever questions we had, he would take them. And he was laying down on the putting green. And yeah, it was just really cool to see kind of a Tiger not in the spotlight side of him. And, you know, you always see the professional side of him and his image, you know, being portrayed. And it was just cool to get to know him more on a personal level, but also just to see how he functions, you know, when none of the paparazzi and cameras are around. So, yeah, that was a really cool experience.
Obviously, that motivation worked. You guys, as you mentioned, won that national championship. That was a first for Stanford. How big was that for you and for that program, do you think?
That was huge. Yeah. We had a really tough season up until that point. You know, and I don't really exactly remember the reasons why, but we just, you know, didn't perform the way we wanted to throughout the season. And then going into nationals, Coach was like, you know what, this is our last chance. Like, it's the last tournament of the year. Why don't we make the best of it? And somehow we pulled through and did it. And, I just remember watching Mariah come down the last stretch, and just, it was like, you know, a feeling that you'll never forget type of environment. And, you know, you're walking down the fairway with your team and you're all like walking so fast you can't keep up with each other and just like screaming and like hanging on to each other and just like it's indescribable. But that was one of the best golf experiences, I think, of my career thus far. And just to be able to do it with a team that I truly cared about, and I'm still like best friends with every one of them to this day. It was really cool.
Obviously, you get to see Maria out there on tour. Who else are you friends with? Who do you hang out with on tour? Who do you play your practice rounds with?
Yeah, Mariah and I stay together some weeks when we don't have our own like housing situations or whatever. But yeah, I hang out a lot with Charlotte Thomas. We were the same year in school. And then Caroline Inglis, who's actually has been injured, but hopefully she'll be back this year. Sarah Schmelzel, she also was the same year in school as us. Yeah, we all went to school around the same time, you know, to different programs, obviously, but yeah, it's funny how in college you're kind of stuck with your team and then everybody disperses and graduates, and then you kind of form a new, you know, new friendships with girls on tour that, you know, went to different schools, and maybe you didn't even think that you'd be friends down the road, but something about 8 to 9 hour drives kind of makes you become closer.
Well, one person that's out on tour as well, your boyfriend, Ryan DeVoe. Mm-hmm. We get in trouble if we didn't bring him up on here because he made this happen. To the listeners.
Des, yeah.
I would give him credit and let you say nice things about him, but here's the question I have for you. Mm-hmm. What is the one reason, other than being your boyfriend, you would never hire him?
Oh, gosh. I've never thought about that. Because the only reason I've ever thought of is because we're dating, I don't want to spend 24/7 with him. As odd as that sounds. I don't know. He is very... no, but talkative is a good thing on the golf course, at least.
Is he just annoying with the Dallas Stars stuff? Or,
gosh, I can't think of... Yeah, maybe, I mean... Considering I'm a Sharks fan, that might get us into
there you go.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not really known for his green book making or like green read skills, so that could be one of the reasons, maybe. But I thought we'd give him a little poke.
Yeah. No, if we weren't dating, I'd hire him in a heartbeat. He's awesome, and he's been so influential in kind of my decisions, especially. I mean, not just hiring caddies, but also. Just the mental side of the game. He has a different perspective. He gets to see it from kind of a third party, and see it with a lot of different players. So yeah, he's learned a lot on his time on tour, and then, kind of passed that wisdom down to me. So yeah, he's been really helpful.
So what does that mean though, to have someone that, you're that close with that's supporting you, but he knows the game, he knows the ins and outs of the sport. I mean, that just makes it a lot easier.
Yeah. I really appreciate that he knows golf. When we first started dating, I actually, both of us were not, we weren't jumping on the idea of dating somebody in the golf world, because it's so small, and because, you're with these people week in, week out. It can, turn very gossipy and classic kind of high school environment. But I won't go. I'll spare you the details.
Go sit in the caddies lounge at a PGA Tour tournament for anybody out there listening.
Oh my gosh. But yeah, I mean, it really helps that he understands the mental game, and kind of he's managing people's emotions, every single day. And so to kind of have somebody that's seen the ups and downs of it with a lot of different players, it really helps, because you start to feel like, gosh, am I crazy? Am I the only one that's, going through this, mental struggle of, having your kind of person attached to a score at the end of the day. So, he's been really helpful in kind of allowing me to detach myself from that and kind of look at golf from a less emotional standpoint. And kind of also get an analytical viewpoint from somebody that's not in my head, so it kind of diversifies the perspective in that respect. But yeah, it's really helpful to have him out there.
For sure. And you guys have actually played golf together. I remember you guys played out. Was it when you were in Scotland? Is that correct?
Yeah.
How many strokes did you have to give him to make that competitive?
Well, he's always in it, the one initiating how many strokes I give him. So I don't really get a say, but I think the record has it that I gave him 18 strokes and he beat me by one. So it was pretty even, but he hits it. I mean, it's just like unbelievable how far he hits it. And so I'm always saying that that's an advantage. And he's saying that he hits it far, but he also hits it that far offline. So he's like, in the fescue and all that. But in Scotland, at least, you can get on the green if you're in the fescue, but on American golf courses, it's a little tougher with the trees. So
that's the old adage, though. That just proves everything. Those jerks, those jerks out on Twitter. They go against the ladies' game. This just proves like Dez is a great golfer and needs 18 strokes to beat his girlfriend that's out on the LPGA tour and can barely do that. He's probably he probably asked to play the same tees as you too with those 18 strokes.
No, he was. I'll give him that. He was a few tee boxes back.
He's a gambler. He knows what he's
doing. Yeah. He's a great putter though. So he'll, you can never discount him on the greens. He'll make putts from literally everywhere. So you're kind of in trouble if he hits the green in regulation.
Nice. I just want to hear one story. I read something about you getting two bracelets with two sayings on them. Can you kind of share a little bit of what the story is behind that and why they're important to you?
Well, so actually one of them I got at a pro-am, which was kind of ironic because I had already had the other one for about a year or two before that. But the first one I got was Live What You Love. And I initially found these bracelets. They're called Mantra Bands. And right after I graduated, our Stanford Women's Golf went to an event and they got them as tee prizes, and they all came back with these like bracelets that said, had different phrases on them. And I was like, wow, that's like such a great idea that, you know, I kind of want one, like, where do I get one? And so I had visited right after that, you know, story I told you about nearly quitting. A couple weeks after that, actually, I went to go visit one of my other teammates. And she's from Denver, Colorado. So I spent about a week with her and kind of just taking a break from it all. We went fishing. I fly fished for the first time, which was really, really hard, by the way. And I got this bracelet that I was like, okay, I mean, may as well just wear it and kind of remind myself to, yeah, I mean, do just that, live what you love, and kind of remember why I'm on this journey, you know, playing professional golf and stuff, just because I love competing and I love the sport. And I, you know, the sport's been part of my life for as long as I can remember. So it was just kind of a reminder to, you know, do what I love and kind of love what I do in the same light. And then maybe, yeah, a year and a half after that, I went to a pro-am down in Southern California. And the course, I think they selected this phrase because the course was actually called Journey. It's called Journey at Pechanga Resort and Casino. And so we got these bracelets that say enjoy the journey. And I was like, wow, it's kind of weird that, you know, a year and a half later, and I've learned so much that, you know, I'm kind of reminded again by these little bracelets, you know, to kind of enjoy every, you know, enjoy the process, enjoy the challenges that come along with professional golf. And so now I wear both and they're kind of a cool reminder every day that I put them on. And yeah, I love them.
All right, Lauren, we appreciate your time. You told us some great stories and we're super proud of you. We've obviously been tracking your career ever since episode one when Dez came on here and talked about how good your game is. So we appreciate your time on the podcast. We look forward to your full-time status on the LPGA Tour this year and can't wait to catch up with you in the future.
Sweet, thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Lauren Kim, we'll have you on the podcast anytime. That Tiger story, I was fired up.
That was cool.
That was cool. I think she has his number. I think she's lying. I just don't think she wants to give it to Dez more than anything. Let's go into the week coming up, the week ahead here. We're not going to do a birdie or bogey segment this week. We got a lot in the mailbag. We are overflowing. Your email reached capacity. Your DMs on Instagram reached capacity.
They were on fire.
So we're gonna skip on the birdie or bogey this week. Again, you can throw us some suggestions for birdie or bogeys any week too. So. Instead, we're going to go to things coming up this week in the golf world, considering nobody is playing. Pretty much no one's playing. They're playing Turkey. Who cares? President's Cup picks come out tomorrow. How is this being announced? And projections? Yeah, predictions is what I wanted. Predictions do you have?
We've got Ernie Els is going to come up first. He's going to do it, I guess it'll be Tuesday night. So we'll see when this podcast comes out and Tuesday night?
Wednesday night.
Well,
it's Tuesday.
We're recording. Now, wow. Technically, yeah. I am lost. Wednesday night. And then Tiger will be the next day as well. So, we're going to see. So, Ernie's going to pick first. He's got his four. My prediction, Sanjay M, who we've talked about.
It's called Sanjay.
You would think, although Ben On's been playing very well as well. So, I mean, that could be an interesting pick as well.
He's going to show up if you don't pick him.
He probably is going to that way. Corey Connors, I really think, you know, based on his play of late, just looking even through his finishes of late, I think he is going to be the Canadian that makes it. I'm not quite sure as far as Adam Hadwin. He's higher ranked in world rankings, but I think Connors has really been putting on a show of late. And he's got a history at Royal Melbourne as well. He shot 63 there during an amateur event years ago. He's, as he said, he's still got his name on the wall.
That'll do.
Yeah, so Jason Day, I think, you know, although he hasn't been on the greatest amount of form, I think they're going
to
take him
you
as well.
To.
Because you were in Australia. Mm-hmm. So, I'll put those ones out there for sure. We'll see about a few others.
Yeah, I agree with you on all those. Jason Day is a lock. I don't think it's kind of like Tiger. Tiger's a lock. He's going to get picked. On the American side, I think that the choice, who do you think of the choices between Patrick Reed and...
Well, Ricky Fowler, a lot of people are discussing whether he's going to take Fowler or not.
He hasn't been playing.
But that's the thing. You know, people are like, oh, he's a lock. But I mean, and a few other
experts. He should be, but he hasn't been playing.
Yeah. I mean, I'd say Reed for sure. He's been on a really solid streak here coming in. So I think he's a choice that way. I'd love to see Tony Finau. He's been playing well, and I think he'd be pretty exciting in match play. So, you know, those would be solid picks. Gary Woodland, I think he's got to be a lock. I mean, he's just played so well. And obviously winning a major championship this year. And you're talking about tools to make use of in match play. And that's why guys like Finau and Woodland are, you know, really important. Tiger's really important as far as hitting greens. You got to look at the formats that are going to be played in these events. Granted, we know what the outcome probably is going to be. We're not really sure that.
How many points are up?
Total?
Yeah.
24? You mean as far as overall in the matches all the time?
Like, overall.
I think it's 10-1-1 is the overall.
No, but sorry. Let me clarify. So there's 24 points at stake in the President's Cup. Like, the U.S. is going to win like 20-4 or something. Like, they always win. It's silly. They could pick Brendan Todd. Why don't you pick Brendan Todd? He just won. He's a good pick. Like, it doesn't really matter. Maybe Ricky gets chosen, but I think Patrick Reed's going to be there for sure. Just the guys, he's the Poulter of the U.S. team.
30 points, actually, 30? For President's Cup.
Okay,
so.
26 to 4. There you go. It doesn't really matter. It might be fun. I'm obviously cheering for the...
it's going to be another one that I'm there to watch the golf course. Royal Melbourne's fabulous. You know, so that'll be part of it. And, hey, it's another opportunity to watch golf in the middle of the night.
Exactly. Not too much else. PGA Tour will head off to Mayakoba in Mexico. And next week, you know, Q School or Q Stage, whatever you want to call it, for the Korn Ferry Tour, Q Series. I don't even know what
they call it. Q Series is the LPGA. Okay. Q School is the Korn Ferry Tour.
Okay, so it is Q School for the Korn Ferry Tour is going on, second stage wrapping up this
week.
Yeah,
we've got 11 Canadians left in the last four stages now. Unfortunately, Brad Fritch, who's been on the podcast, missed the week before, lamented a little bit about shortness, not having enough length to get through. There are 11 Canadians still left in the four other sites. And as of this point, we have some that are actually contending as well. So we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah, well, you're obviously cheering for any and all Canadians. And Brad will turn it around. He actually had a great tweet on Twitter, obviously, where he's basically said something like, yeah, it was just way too short. He's also lost a ton of weight again. He's down. He saw
199.
Yeah. Saw on the scale. Of one
Yeah. We actually had a discussion about that as far as the length. We just sort of took that. We talked about that a little bit after he tweeted, 2 years ago in the PGA Tour, he averaged 160 miles an hour. But the difference is that his launch angle is super low. It's always been low. So he's a guy I think that could gain a bit by launching it more. And I think he's off to a little bit of an equipment fitting early in the year. And maybe that'll take care of some things for him.
Yeah. I mean, maybe back in 2014, I could fit you. Yeah, there's other guys out there now that will make sure you get that launch angle to where it's going to be. He obviously can play. He'll be back. He'll be back. We're not too worried about it. I think we should hit the mailbag. We got a lot in there. And then we'll hit the tip of the week to wrap it up. How does that sound?
Sounds good.
All right. Let's do it. All right, the mailbag's back yet again. We got a lot of questions this week. So what do we got? Scotty in the mailbag, pull them on out.
First one here, destinations to play in Ontario. I didn't get that one. That must have came to you.
That did come to me.
All right.
It was just, like if you're going on a buddy's trip, a trip with your friends, wives trip, whatever, where do you want to? Where would you go in Ontario to recommend?
Probably first pick, probably TBC Toronto. Great spot near Caledon, 54 holes there, 3 Doug Carrick design golf courses. They're in the process of doing some infrastructure building there, some different things for accommodations and things like that. But great spot to go, especially if you want to play some quality golf courses. One location, good pricing. Muskoka is always good, can be very expensive, but always a nice spot to head to check out. And Niagara is actually pretty good too. They've got some good golf courses down there. You got a casino down there, two casinos actually. And that one's been getting a lot of attention of late.
Yeah, I think you've nailed it. For me, it's the Muskokas. That's my lifestyle.
That's your jam.
It's my lifestyle. Slow living, life by the lake, get up play nice and early. Cold nights, hot summer days. You got breweries up there. You got great food. It's cottage. People are always in a good mood. They're at the cottage.
Yeah, for sure.
It is expensive, but if you're going up there to name a few courses, obviously you want to play Muskoka Bay. You want to play Deerhurst. If you're heading up even north, where was that place? I played up near Perry.
In McKellar, Manitou.
Ridge at Manitou. Great.
Deerhurst,
track.
Always a classic there. Taboo. There's no shortage of them up there. That's for sure.
No, and then there's some like holes in the wall that you'll find yourself, and they're great courses too. So for me, absolutely, if you like that slow living and sitting by the dock after a round of 18, that's where you got to go. But you're right on the Niagara front.
Yeah.
If you like wine.
Yeah,
now you can go
definitely.
Do some wine tours exactly. in the afternoon and then play golf in the morning. Then you got the casinos at night. So it really just depends. But those are probably my two favorites to go to. And then, you know, I think Ottawa is a little underrated, too. The city of Ottawa itself is a cool little town. It's not like Toronto. You actually feel like you got everybody there, but it doesn't feel as busy. And then there's a ton of good golf courses there. And then Quebec's just on the other side. There's a spa there. You know, you can't really go wrong, but for me, it's Muskoka every single day of the week.
All right, so question two, somebody says, thinking about putting a 64-degree wedge in my bag, advice. So I don't know if that means they're a little concerned of whether that's a good idea or not, but, you know, I have some thoughts on that, but let's hear yours.
Stop thinking about it.
Yeah. How so? Just don't do it.
Why would you do it?
Yeah, I wouldn't do it either.
You cannot name two players on the PGA Tour that do it.
Well, the only time that you'll see an excessive amount of high lofted wedges is maybe for the Masters or just a certain situations for certain majors. But in most cases, you're not going to see it. And there's a number of reasons for that. But let's just say, first off, it's not a very versatile club.
Nope.
Very precise as far as striking and having to hit it. So it's hard enough for a pro to hit it, let alone an amateur. And really, you've only got 14 clubs in your bag. Why do you want to have something in there that's so one-dimensional? The other side as well is that, you know, your ability to stop the golf ball with a 64-degree wedge is basically from landing angle, and that's about it. There's actually a threshold at one point where if you launch it over a certain degree, about 45 degrees, you'll actually get less friction rather than more. So you're not going to get more spin necessarily from a 64-degree wedge. So don't think that all of a sudden you're going to get 15,000 RPMs of spin. So my advice from me would be say, no, don't do it.
Don't do it. Go to the short game area or something and just practice that shot that you're struggling with rather than try to buy a piece of equipment that is useless, in my opinion.
Yep.
The reason you don't see, like, if you go into your local golf town or whatever right now, you probably are not going to find a 64-degree wedge for a reason, not because they're sold out, because they don't have them, because they're useless. People don't make them. Learn how to hit the shot so you don't have this one club that, you know, you only get 14.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I agree. I mean, I have a 58-degree is the max in my bag. Just found that even with the 60 that I used to carry for years, I do not spin it as much as I do on a 58. 58 is just a lot more versatile. So.
I can make it 60.
Well, exactly. So it's versatility more than anything.
It's a lot easier for me to make my 58 a 60 than it is for you to make your 64 a 50.
100%.
Out of 50, that'd be a lot.
All right, I did a web poll this week, and I want to get your take on it and see what your answer is. If you were limited to one practice area forever, what would it be? And basically, my three options that I put out for people, and I'll tell you their percentages in a minute, but I want to hear your take, would be driving range, full swings only, short game, wedge area, basically, and the putting green. What would you choose?
Short game, every day. It's my favorite thing to do is get creative on the short game shots. You know, my 58 is a club that I replace all the time. I have to replace every year almost, it feels like, just because
you wear it out.
Yeah, if I have half an hour, I'm not going to hit balls. I'd rather go chip and putt. I find that the way we actually teach golf, maybe I'm wrong, it's my own theory, is backwards. I think we should start putting, then we should start chipping,
100%.
Then we should go further and rather than start on the range.
Yeah,
everything can be figured out there. And it's fun. It's way more fun. Like, for anybody that's like they want some other than just chipping, one of my favorite games is you know up and down. Grab one ball, you play the partner, you pick a spot, you go up and down, and that's all you do. It's just Yeah, 100% the short game area. Way more fun.
Yeah, so when we looked at the poll, 24% took the driving range full swings, 8% took the putting green, and just like you, 68% took the short game wedge area. So a lot of people thinking about that part of the game. 8% is awful low for the putting green, though. I mean,
it's I think it's normal. I think people don't spend enough time there.
I think you're right. I mean, I've spent a lot of time on being lonely on putting greens, that's for sure. It is a big part of the game, so maybe I'd like to see that number bumped up a bit, but hey, that's not up to me. It's what people chose on the Twitter poll.
Cool. What's our next question?
All right. What clubs are you looking to change in your own golf bags for 2020? Obviously, you're going to be changing out a wedge because that's going to be worn out. But a particular other club that you're seeking out for 2020?
Not necessarily. I think the biggest thing for me, I might have to switch my irons just for the shaft. I think I've realized I need to get a little bit more launch. I can do it if I want to. I don't like to hit it that high just because the swing doesn't feel right when I'm doing it. I was hitting a much higher ball flight with a lighter shaft in the previous year.
Okay.
So I'm thinking I might have to go to a new set of irons. It's cheaper usually for me to get irons being in the industry with the right shaft and replace.
And how many sets
of
irons did you have this year?
That's 3. The wife's, she already hates me, so may as well get the irons. But it's, if anything, if I could do shafts, maybe I might head down to Accra and see if they can fit me up for some shafts, because I actually love my irons. But if anything, it might be a wedge, hybrid or something like that. But I really don't need anything. I think it's in a good place right now, but it's the shafts that are the only thing popping out to me right now.
Yeah, not a lot of changes for me in my bag. I'll do the same. Wedges will turn over this year. I've had them in, I think, a year and a half, the set I've had now, so they're getting pretty worn out. Putter's pretty much stock in there. Hybrid that I mentioned in the last show, it stayed there for a long time, so I think it's going to stay there. 3-wood's good. Driver's good. Irons, I might switch out this year. Been 2 years with the set that I've got now, so they're just kind of getting time as far as wear is concerned. Not really looking for any particular advantage in a new set of irons, just basically a straight, more or less just a replacement more than anything.
That being said, I can be bought.
Of course,
if somebody's out there and they're like, hey, we love the podcast, we want to give you full set of clubs, I'll change them right then and there. I can be bought. No?
I'm not surprised.
Okay, next question.
All right, so what's the one big mistake the average golfer makes when getting fit for a driver? I thought that was an interesting one because I know this listener watches a lot of YouTube videos. I've got some advice on this, but you go ahead first.
For me, it was always loft. It was too little loft.
Yeah.
The thought process, and it generally comes from an older clientele that necessarily feels it can't carry as far and they need the roll. So if it comes lower, it's going to have low spin, it's going to roll longer. And the biggest mistake there, the reason it's a mistake, you cannot control roll. The weather conditions, the ground, you know, yes, it's good to get the ball on the ground in Scotland. Over here, you do want to get as much carry distance as you possibly can.
Yeah.
I always see people going too little loft.
Mm-hmm.
And then almost the opposite, though, when we're talking the ladies game, I found a lot of ladies went too high aloft a lot of the time in my fitting.
Yeah, I see that. Yep.
That they actually were hurting themselves based on what was swing. So I think we get too into this thought process of the slower the swing, the higher the loft, and everything, and then let's get it rolling. It doesn't really matter.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I always found. What about you?
Actually, in a similar vein, but for a different reason. Big mistake that I see a lot of golfers getting when they go to a fitting is they're seeking that one long drive.
Yeah.
So you go to a fitting, and they end up jacking down the loft so that the spin can come down and maximize a distance off of one shot. And really what it comes down to is consistency. When you're out there playing, you've got to be able to have not only accuracy left and right, but you've got to have consistent dispersion front and back as well. So that's great if you can hit it off the center of the club and it all of a sudden is only going 1700 RPMs and, you're getting this maximum shot. But all of a sudden, if you take that same club and hit it off the heel or toe and you get some wild knuckleball that doesn't stay in the air, I'd rather get in a situation that you're going to have a club that, you know, you can hit it a little bit off and still get something out of it. So just consistency as far as that. So
don't, I made that mistake too.
Oh yeah. Don't necessarily go to that fitting and, you know, have that fitter go, oh wow, this is the one you hit the furthest. Well, if you hit it the furthest the one time, it doesn't necessarily, it's mm-hmm. not going to necessarily do you any good. So.
No, I made that mistake, man, many of times going for that longer driver. I'm not a long guy, like long hitter. That sounds
well, everybody
terrible.
Gets sucked into it. I mean, yeah. that's the thing. Our ego says, oh, we want to hit it long. And, you know, that's sort of the mantra, the marketing that we hear all the time. So you go to that fitting and then all of a sudden somebody finds you a few extra yards. You're thinking, that's great. That's exactly what I need. But we forget that, you know, we want to have that every time, not just one shot where we hit it 290 and the next shot we hit it 220.
100%. All right. What's our next question on the menu?
All right. Somebody wants to know, obviously we're 40 episodes in now. This is episode 41 of the podcast. I mean, we could have maybe saved this to, you know, the end of the year, but do each of you have a favorite interview episode from this year so far?
Man, that's a
tough one. That's a loaded
one. Question. I'm just going through our list right now.
This took me a while. I thought about this one.
Yeah, no, there's so many here that I look back at, our first episode, the chaos that ensued was wrought with Dez going. Then when he came back with him and Nate, that was a super fun episode. I'm gonna mention, so the time, you know, Martin.
Okay, you got to pick one.
Martin showing up at the Buffalo,
oh, at Buffalo
Wild Wings
yeah.
to out of the blue, like that was cool. I think the one I'm going to go with, and it was weird. It was the one I was just the most proud of the person I was with, was when Nate won that major and he came back with Hannah Green. Just the change where he still was so humble, but you could see him coming a little bit out of his shell, telling some good stories. And he was just so, you could tell how proud of himself he was in that moment. And it was just like, it was cool. It was just like, this guy was with us 2-3 weeks ago, and here he is walking major championships at an LPGA tour event. And he's when he get him going, he's hilarious too.
He
so
is.
Yeah, no, that was just, I think back just looking at that, I went through the whole list twice there, and it was the first one that popped out as mine, and I'm going to go back to that one.
Yeah.
I think I might have to re-listen to that. What a cool moment.
It's hard to think back because, you know, we've been fortunate to have a number of guests here, and we've had some funny incidents and just great circumstances with, you know, things like wins and things like that. For me, I'm actually going to go episode 8, where I actually got to sat down with Brad Faxon. Just happened to be he was coming to Ottawa. Just a coincidence. He was going to be there with Titleist. Made time to jump on the podcast and just sit in an office at the
Brad Faxon.
Yeah, Brad Faxon. I mean, one of the best putters of all time, one of the nicest guys in the all time in golf. Just to be able to sit with him for, you know, 25-30 minutes, chat on air, him to tell stories, and then, you know, just sitting afterwards. And I sort of wish, actually, I should have kept the tape rolling, but, you know, we stayed and chatted for another 20-25 minutes afterwards, and talking about his interaction with Rory and some of his thoughts and philosophies about coaching and putting. And obviously I was gleaning lots of information from that, not only for myself but for my students as well. So that's probably one of the highlights. I won't always just call it a favorite. I'll just say it's a highlight, but definitely there's been a lot of favorites so far,
for sure. All right, we got one more in
this
the mailbag.
This one's fun. This one's a little different.
Yeah, so this one came. Ryan Barath actually wrote an article for Golf WRX, and he talked about it on his podcast. A set of clubs he built for under $500 US, right? The Golf WRX is a US brand.
Yep.
My buddy sent me the article, thought it was cool, and said you should do this. And I said, that's a cool idea. Obviously, with $500 Canadian, it's a little different. So
yeah,
I gave
that's a little tight.
I did a little bit of a quick math there. I'm not great at math, so I moved us up to $800.
All
so
right.
Basically, the question is, what set would you build if you only had $800? Now, this coming into play, quick preface on that.
Yeah.
Sorry, wow, words. We assumed we had a golf bag. We got a golf bag. It was a gift. Here's your bag. At worst, you know, you can make a bag, right? And you
just
have balls, you got tees, things like that.
Yeah.
You just have no clubs.
Right.
You got shoes. You got shoes even. You can play barefoot. So
of course you can.
You and I went, I said, we didn't tell each other what we were going for. We just had $800.
Yeah.
Go online.
Just found a used equipment site. We're not saying which one it was or whatever, but at least we used sort of the same one.
Go on to this website and find yourself, build yourself a set of clubs for $800. Why don't you go first? Because I haven't heard any of these.
All right. Let's start with, why don't we start right with the driver? I mean, I found a Ping Rapture V2 driver which you're probably familiar with back in the day. $80.
What was the condition like?
Condition was okay. It was okay. It's old enough that it was going to be all right. Yeah. Decent enough head shape, you know, decent speed off that feel wise. I mean, it would have been nicer maybe to, you know, I regret it now because I ended up being a little short of the 800, just a little bit. Maybe I could have, you know, upgraded a little bit more, maybe got into a Ping G30 or something like that, which was a pretty forgiving driver. But that's the one I ended up with, was the Rapture V2 for $80.
Stiff flex?
I went with a stiff flex just because I looked at it and it was kind of their tour sort of shaft.
So you might have to lay off. We're not going to be able to hammer.
Heavier weight, but, you know, I am 49 now.
Yeah, we know. So for the driver, for me, I found a Titleist 915D. You know what?
Did you have this one before?
Why don't you keep going? Because I want to get in the mindset of how you built this.
Okay.
So there's a little spoiler there, obviously, the driver, and I'll get to that later. But
you want me just to run through my
set? Go through it, and then kind of what was the most important thing, but keep going.
The biggest thing I wanted was a set that I was sort of familiar with a lot of the clubs. Maybe I tested them before. I liked the head shapes. I was familiar with the feels. That was really where I was going. I wasn't particularly looking exactly at conditions so much until I came down to sort of the wedges where I wanted something that, you know, had some grooves on them, because obviously you're buying something used, you can get something worn, and then, you know, paying a lot of extra attention even to the putter as well and getting something comfortable. So in the fairway, I actually went with an X Hot Pro fairway.
Oh, that club was great.
That was a great club.
I have the two. I wish I had the one. But,
yeah.
Oh, what a club.
It was solid. Love the shape of it. I played Callaway Fairway Woods. I actually have a forward. I still have it at home. A big Bertha forward. I played that for years. I just love the shape of that fairway wood. It performed really well. So the X Hot Pro was giving me a little bit more of a modern upgrade to that. And $70. I couldn't beat it. There was an X Flex shaft in it, and I think it was 15 degrees. I don't have that down here.
That's fine.
Yeah. So then from there in my bag, I go down to a hybrid from there. I don't carry a 5-wood, and I like something for a hybrid that I can, you know, launch pretty well, but I don't like something that's too bulky. And I ended up with a TaylorMade R15 Rescue X Flex, 19 degrees, Fuji Speeder in it, and for $80, I couldn't beat it. Very versatile club, kind of really bridges going from a fairway to an iron. Something versatile enough that I can hit it off the tee or hit it off the deck. Now, my biggest deal that I found was a set of Mizuno MP60 irons for $140.
Yeah, if you like, we're not going to give these where we bought this from, but message one of us on Instagram.
They may be gone. They're probably gone already.
If they're still around, I'll tell you the website.
So forged, you know, slight cavity back in them, really nice shape to them. Mizuno's made great irons for many, many years. Always look at some of the classic irons, but I happen to be looking actually higher price point at some other sets. I was looking for some 62s, some other models, and it just so happened that I put in Mizuno and boom, this MP60 set popped up, $140. Couldn't beat that. Nope. It was a quick grab, and I figured that was going to leave me a little bit more money to spend on wedges and my putters. So for $140, away we went. All right, down to the wedges. Did a little bit of a mix set here. Tried to stay with something familiar in the club that I use the most in my wedges, which was the Vokey SM7. I did a D-grind in the 58 degree, and that's the club I really use a lot in the wedges, kind of like 92, 93 yards in. So I picked one of those up for $100. I grabbed a Callaway MD4 Chrome for my 50, $110 for that. A little bit more than maybe I wanted to target it at, but nice shape. It was hard to find 50 degrees online.
It was. Wait till you hear mine.
That was a difficult test. I had never really thought about it too much, but I seemed to find a lot of excess inventory in the 54 and 56 degree department, but 50s were hard to find, so that one sort of fit the bill. And then I mixed in a 53 degree Ben Hogan TK sand wedge, only $51 in between there. And you know, like the shape of it, loft worked out well, and I couldn't beat it for that price. And then I finished off the set. I wanted see if I could find a mallet design. Ended up finding an Odyssey Tank Cruiser V-line putter. Nice mallet, nice and heavy, got some good lines on it. I like something like
that.
You
like your heavier putters.
I do like the heavier putters. I do usually play something that's counterbalanced, but this is heavy enough that I can make use of it, and I got that at 102. So my set price pre-tax ended up at $753. So I still had a few dollars left over. As I said, I might go back and, you know, if I wanted to bump it up that extra $47, I might be able to find maybe a little hotter driver or something like that. But, you know, if I was going to do this set, I'd say my biggest advice to people would be make sure you spend enough on your driver and that putter. And those are the key things in there as far as from scoring clubs. And as I mentioned, make sure your wedges have some grooves on them.
Absolutely. My thought process here when I did it, I started with the irons was the first thing I wanted to get out of the way. I wanted a nice set of irons. You're going to be using them on out of the most outside of a putter per se. And my putter that I usually use is a pretty standard blade putter, so I wasn't too worried about that. It was actually the last thing I went for.
That was an interesting challenge too, like just trying to balance it to see what you're going to put in and how much you're going to save to, you know, to get into the price range.
So yeah, I started with irons, but I'll start at the top. As I said, I went with the Titleist 915 D2, had a stiff flex, nice shaft in there, $140, was in great condition. I said I need a little bit more, something newer. I'm not a long driver by any stretch, so I need something newer.
Something
on that
a little
front.
Pop.
Exactly, and I've had the 917 in the past. I've had the 910 in the past. I didn't see anything like that. Would have loved a 910 D2. Mm. That was probably my favorite driver of all time that I've ever had, I'm not going to lie. That's not true, the G30. But I didn't want to spend the extra bit on the G30, so yeah. I went with the Titleist 915 D2. Pretty happy with it. Actually, that's a lot. I found a G30, but it was an inch and 3/4 short. And I like a short driver, but that's like 43.75 if I'm doing my math quick.
Very careful when you're looking online too. That's the other thing for people. When I went looking through this, it seems sometimes I thought I found something that was going to be great, and then I looked and, you know, the flex was off, or as you said, you know, you get something that's short or super upright or something like that. So be careful when you're doing the shopping like this, people.
So for my 3-wood, I found an Adams XTD TI fairway.
I saw that one too. I saw that too. Yeah, that was pretty cool. Nice shape on that thing.
It had nice shape. It had this good look. It just classic look for a 3-wood. I remember that thing, and it launched. It was a great 3-wood. I didn't usually like hitting off the ground, but you know, it was one that I recognized. I remember hitting, you know, back in the day of the shop, so I was pretty happy about this. This next part's pretty funny. We picked the same.
That's funny.
We picked the same hybrid, so it would probably be a race here. I don't use extra stiff in most of my clubs. The reason I do that is I find hybrids are really meant for the slicer, the fader. So I always try to. I'm not a fade by. Regularly hit a fade, so I try to go up and flex with my hybrids. I wanted more of a driving iron if I'm ever hitting them, so I went with the extra stiff, end up with the exact same club as you, which was the TaylorMade R15 Rescue.
That's hilarious.
Three, same shaft, everything for $80. So here we are, getting there. The irons, these I was so happy with. That was bottom. Bridgestone J38 cavity backs, 4 to pitching wedge with S300s in them.
Nice.
For 305. It said very good condition. Folks, if you're looking for irons and you're like you're kind of a player, you're not like a, you know, a 1 or a 2 and can still, because you can find some good blades on that website, but you know, you want a little bit of forgiveness, go buy these. Message me. I'll tell you where they are because they were nice. Bridgestone irons have always been. I've always been a fan of their irons.
Yeah, they're nice.
Super nice. So that's what I went with. Those are $305. This is when things got a little bit interesting for me. So
based on the look here, I'm looking at your notes. Interesting.
I went with the 58 degree first. I think you said the same thing. I wanted something I was familiar with. One of the Ping Glide 58 degree. It was in very good condition. That was the key for me was I need a 58 with a lot of grooves.
Yeah.
So that was $65.
That's
think
a steal.
It is a steal. And I think Ping's, since for a long time, hasn't got the much love with their wedges, but I've always been a fan of their wedges, and I know that wedge very well. So was happy with that. Picked up a Vokey SM5 54 degree. This wasn't in great shape, though. It was
SM5's a few generations back.
Yeah,
so.
It was $50.
All right.
Which
but it's
is,
a 54, so.
Yeah, it's a 54. I might chip with that. I might hit some bunker shots with that. I'm not too concerned about it, to be honest with you. I needed the 58. And then I came into a little bit of a gap. So at this point, I had when I get to the putter, I ran out of money, kind of, and I needed this gap from my pitching wedge in that set was a 47.
Yep.
And a 47 to a 54 is a big gap.
That's a little much.
Yeah. And I thought maybe I could get a 5-wood or something, but a 5-wood goes as far as a 3-hybrid. So I was like, all right, we'll just throw in a gap wedge of sorts. The only thing I could find in was a Wilson Staff 52-degree. I don't even know the brand of the Wilson Staff. It was just Wilson Staff 52-degree for $29 with the intention that I'd throw it into a doorway and end it to a 50-degree.
Yeah, I'm not sure we had modifications as part of this challenge.
Well,
but
I'm modifying it. Technically, I have $5. It would cost you $5 at your local golf course to bend a wedge.
All right,
so
fair enough.
$5, bend that to a 50. So that was $29. Then I finished it up with a Ping Scottsdale TR Answer T putter, a little blade with that T over the top as your Lymonade, black.
Got the True Roll insert.
True Roll
right, the
insert
TR.
Once they switch. Oh, great putter.
That's a steal, too.
Oh, it was I almost bought that, too. I almost bought a lot of this
was actually a problem going through this stuff. It started kind of feeding that used club addiction where you start going through it and go, ooh, that's good. Or, oh, look at that set of irons. And, and then I had to, I had to move down to my office where I could look at all the clubs that are already sitting there and go, okay, I don't need any more.
No, you did not. And I finished at $790. Awesome. This is a set. I mean, obviously, if I needed it for a while, I can make
it
work.
Play it.
There's some spots that I'd probably want to redo all the wedges if I could reinvest in terms of actually that.
Yep.
That's my biggest concern.
Fun challenge, though.
But it was a fun challenge. I guess we'll be sharing a hybrid when we go out to play. But it was a great question and a good way to wrap up the mailbag this week. So thanks, everyone, for sending in their questions, whether to Scott or myself on Instagram or on Twitter. But let's wrap it up. One last thing we like to do, the tip of the week with the pro. Let's hear it.
Yeah, just tip of the week, doing a lot of indoor work now. It's that time of the year as far as golfers trying to get their games in shape for next year, starting to work on different things. And putting is something that you can work on indoors. And, obviously, you don't have an opportunity in most cases to work on speed because you don't have, 30-foot, 40-foot putting surfaces to make use of. But start line is something that you can work on a lot in putting. And that's, the ability to start the golf ball on the line where you need it to is a definite skill that everybody can work on, and they can work on it indoors and they don't need a lot of space to do it. And basically all you need to do is to set up two targets, and you can set up two coins. It can be two tees on the ground, set them like two ball widths apart and 2 feet from where you're at, and just work on getting the golf ball to start between those lines. And there's not really a lot to it, not really going to get into too much technical aspect of it, but just work on the ability to control the club face and to get the ball starting on that line. And if you can do that, you'll find that your putting's a lot better when the spring comes.
It's a great tip. Gives you something to do all winter. It's kind of the only thing I'm going to really be practicing. Try to get a little bit of indoor swings here and there before our trips down south, whenever those may be. That's it for the podcast this week. Going to be a little bit of an off week, so please send us some stories on Instagram, on Twitter. Make sure while you're listening to subscribe to the podcast on any and all platforms you can. We do appreciate it. Thank you for the questions yet again. Next week, we'll come back with some birdie to bogey. And most importantly, I want to thank Lauren Kim for coming on the podcast. Great to have her on. We're really proud of her making it onto the LPGA Tour full-time next year. It's been a grind. Q School is a grind, but she's got it. She's got her card. It's locked and loaded. That's it for the podcast this week. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll see you next week. Yesterday, right into slow motion, and a day like today, my boat's